Dylan Mortimer is a Kansas City artist. He's living in Brooklyn right now, and he's waiting for a lung transplant. Not his first lung transplant, his second one. Dylan has cystic fibrosis, a genetic condition that causes his lungs to fill with a thick kind of mucus. He's had it his whole life. And after getting a lung transplant the first time, Dylan went a whole day without coughing for the first time in his life. Things looked good. He kept making art. He toured research labs and pharmaceutical companies. He climbed a freaking mountain. But now his lung capacity has dipped back down, and it's low enough that he's on the waiting list for new lungs once again. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're checking in with the artist and pastor about his journey. Dylan Mortimer, good morning.
Good morning.
So I want to start with the story of your tree in Swope Park. For Open Spaces, you made a piece called Bronchial Tree. Can you explain it?
Yeah, actually, it was called Tree, comma, Broken Tree. So, you know, the idea was to take a dying tree and to paint it and glitter it and, you know, kind of revive it. We looked through the park and found a tree that was dying, you know, did all that. And little did I know that that process would seal the tree and cause it to actually revive and regrow.
Because you were, you know, going to metaphorically revive it.
Right. That was the idea. It was to kind of a glistening, you know, a dying yet glistening tree. And it had all these references to my own bronchial tree in my own life. And then it, you know, actually did revive. So that was, you know, I wish I could say I planned that exactly, but I had not. It kind of happened. And, you know, enliven the metaphor all the more.
Well, you know, so you are aware, because I've mentioned this to you. I went to see it a few weeks ago, and it started snowing on my way to the park. So I ended up not getting out of my car. I just sat there, and I was sitting there in the snow looking at a dead pink tree that was growing new leaves with snow falling around it. And everything about the whole scene was so improbable that I felt this immense reassurance. Just considering the news you were beginning to share on social media about your health.
Right.
Can you update us on what you had been sharing?
Yeah. So, you know, I received new lungs almost 2 years ago. And, you know, we just recently moved to New York City. And weeks before we moved, they found some rejection in the new lungs. And so I've been battling that. And it's been a quick decline with rejection from antibodies, basically. And so... So now I'm being evaluated for another double lung transplant.
Can you talk about, when you say rejection, what that means and what that feels like?
Yeah, there's all different kinds of rejection, but mine is from antibodies. So basically the donor lungs had antibodies that I don't have, and my body is fighting that. And so, you know, I feel fine on the day-to-day, but just my airways are really restricted. And in fact, like for me, my oxygen is still really good. But when I go up a flight of stairs or, for instance, getting to this interview battling subways in New York City traffic, I arrived here with 30 seconds to spare and I'm a little out of breath. But so like that's the results of the rejection. You know, so I don't look to be in a critical state, but you know, again, you know, walking a few blocks gets me really winded, kind of feels like you're breathing through a straw. It has more asthmatic-like symptoms.
You were saying recently that your lungs had gone down to 18% capacity.
On the lung function, yeah. Yeah, so that's a test they do when you blow out air as fast as you can. That's measuring what you can get out and how fast. So my oxygen still, you know, at rest is still like 97, 98, really good. You know, yeah. So it's a battle. So that's the physical. Of course, the emotional toll of it has been a lot. You know, it's kind of, oh, my gosh, here we are again. And, you know, in some ways, a lot different from before. You know, with having CF, I'm not coughing all the time. I'm not coughing up blood. Those things are nice, but you know, still an attack nonetheless. And so it's been an effort to, you know, find peace, find hope in the middle of a storm in which breathing is a struggle again, you know? So that's kind of where I'm at currently.
Yeah. I mean, health, medicine, religion, art, all of those things. We talked at length previously, and those things are really tied up in your world. As I've mentioned, you're also a pastor. And I'm curious about how this part of your journey has been for you spiritually. You know, you've just had your first taste of living without the burden of a major health struggle.
And it was really nice. I mean, the last year and a half have been, I've felt better than any time in my life. And so that's been a joy and a blessing. To your question about the spiritual side of this, you know, I alluded to finding peace in the storm. Everything I said post-transplant is still absolutely true. Grateful to be alive at all, grateful for every breath, you know, really am. And so it does largely come out of that perspective of, okay, when you're that close to not being alive anymore, even a restricted breath is better than, you know, no breath at all. And so it does come out of gratitude and joy and peace, you know, because, yeah, I've slept really well in this. You know, I mean, there's certainly been some anxiety, but it's not been probably what most people would think it would be. And again, some of it's that gratitude, and some of that's like all my artwork and my faith and everything is kind of about finding hope in seemingly hopeless situations, you know, which everybody can relate to in some way, be it health struggle or whatever. But it certainly, from a lot of perspectives, looks hopeless, and it has before. Really, my whole life, from being diagnosed at birth with cystic fibrosis.
You've surpassed your life expectancy at this point.
For sure, yeah, several times over. I mean, you know, when I was born in 1979, the average lifespan for CF patients was late teens. So so I'm like 85 in CF years now, you know? Or 100-something. I mean, so you know, when you look at it from that perspective, it changes things dramatically. And that's not to say that this current situation isn't sad or to be mourned over or grieved over. I mean, it is, and I do grieve over it. But you can simultaneously grieve and have joy and hope. I believe that's the practice I'm pressing into, for sure.
Is it common for cystic fibrosis patients to receive more than one lung transplant?
It's not common. It does happen. You know, it certainly can happen. But yeah, certainly not common. So it was not something I expected, but you know, here we are, and taking a day at a time, a breath at a time.
Your friends have started a GoFundMe page for your family because of logistically what's ahead if you do get the call that some lungs are ready to do this. Can you talk about what you anticipate?
Yeah, it's a little hard to know. I mean, you know, we're at a good place in New York City in terms of great center with Columbia, but there's multiple centers potentially that the surgery could happen, meaning also multiple places you can be listed for, you know, to find a donor. So that can involve quite a bit of travel, you know, in this sort of crazy northeastern, you know, travel circuit here. So there could be a lot of transportation to Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, you know, here. So you know, that's just the transportation. I mean, then we're kind of figuring out with our children and all these kind of things. So it's a lot to juggle and certainly overwhelming at times. But again, you know, just looking back on this year and a half, I had no idea ever I could feel that good or that life could be that, you know, full, and the travel and the places we've been able to go, and just with my kids being able to bike and climb mountains with them, just things I wasn't able to do before.
Will you tell me about climbing a mountain?
Oh my gosh. It's, you know, we went to Colorado 5 months out, and all the doctors were a little nervous, 5 months out of the double lung transplant. And so my doctors were a little nervous about that. And, you know, I just figured, well, if it's bad, I'll just, you know, climb down. I'll go lower altitude. And it was fine the whole time. Oxygen was great. And so, you know, I've kind of just been doing crazy things like that since. In fact, we just went back to Colorado a few weeks ago, and my doctor's looking at me like, are you sure you want to do this? And I'll go, well, if it's, you know, if it's bad, I guess I'll just turn around and get on the plane and come back. But again, oxygen was fine. It was a struggle, but oxygen was fine. And I don't know. I definitely have that spirit and that attitude to just, I'm going to live life to the fullest with every breath I have. And that's the choice, you know, that I choose to make.
What are you making art right now?
Absolutely. Yeah. I've again been blessed to be healthy enough to be in the studio almost every day and you know, yeah, trying to press in and channel some of this, both the pain and the joy that I experience, and you know, try to create and kind of put that into art for sure.
Tell me about the art you're making.
Yeah. You know, so the last show I had in Kansas City was, it was during Open Spaces, and it was primarily framed two-dimensional works. And so it continues to be that for now. You know, a lot of work with broken bronchial branches, that's some of the symbolism and imagery that I'm using a lot, you know, again, with cells, with hospital cords, entangled scars, you know, similar symbols to what I've used before, but again, just new arrangements, new kind of scenery, new symbolism. But that, yeah, the tree, broken tree has been coming in more and more in the two-dimensional work, and that broken bronchial branches, just as they had to break my bronchial branches off and my donors as well, you know, so that symbolism of like a broken tree that is restored, functional, still alive, still breathing, has certainly been a common theme.
A piece by you just went up at KU Med.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a piece from the show Regeneration at Hall Contemporary a few years ago. And so it's in, you know, one of the walkways over 39th Street, the furthest west one. And so, yeah, they got that piece, and also we're trying to find a way to install that forest piece that was at Hall Contemporary somewhere in KU Med, trying to find an appropriate wall, an appropriate space for that to exist there. So
what does it mean to you? I mean, that puts you in conversation with other people who are part of maybe what we don't always think of as a community, but a community of people receiving medical care and often intensive medical care.
Yeah. No, that has been an increasing part of my dialogue, and, you know, both because of the art, but also just social media has made that a reality that it wasn't, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, where, I mean, CF patients kind of aren't supposed to talk to each other. I mean, they're, you know, aren't supposed to be in the same room with each other. There's a movie coming out in March or April about that called 5 Feet Apart, because you're supposed to say 6 Feet Apart.
Why?
So because of transmitting airborne, you know, viruses or diseases, that's a really high risk among CF patients. So be it CF patients or transplant patients, there's, you know, these great online communities and forums for them to discuss, ask questions about things that they really, you know, couldn't do it like that before. So they certainly, in those forums, see the artwork, and the dialogue around it has been neat. Again, that's not something I ever really thought that much about or expected as an artist, but it's been cool to see, you know, fellow patients and fellow, you know, survivors, transplant survivors, and CF survivors engage with the work. Absolutely. It's been a lot of fun.
It's interesting to me that as you've grown up, so has the understanding of cystic fibrosis that the medical world has, and so has the treatment for it. So as you get older, your life expectancy keeps going up with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that weird for you?
It's really neat, you know? I mean, maybe slightly weird, but more just cool, you know, to me that, every year there's been new discoveries, there's been new, you know, it was 1990, I was 10 years old when they discovered the gene. And since then, there's been a lot of development in drugs, in research, and for CF. So they're, you know, it's just getting better and better every day. So more and more hope for those out there with, you know, newborns with CF. Way more hope than when I was a newborn baby.
Dylan Mortimer, thank you so much, and best of luck. Kansas City is pulling for you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Gina. Thank you, Kansas City. Love you.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and in just a minute, we will talk to parents and educators about the role of parent involvement in today's schools. That conversation is coming up next.
Welcome to the annual PTA election.
If you are using popular movies, like the 2016 comedy Bad Moms, as your reference material, you probably think that PTA groups are all about moms looking for status in kind of a mean, judgy way.
I will fight you in the playground. I will fight you in the cafeteria. I will even fight you in the parking lot at Trader Joe's.
But PTAs can be really vital to a school's resources. The money these groups raise through auctions and other events can pay for social workers, extracurricular activities, even, in some cases, entire teaching positions. As KCUR's Ellie Moxley recently discovered, that's turned into an invisible kind of disparity in education, a disparity in parent time and parent resources that puts some districts at a disadvantage.
It's difficult when you have a school population where parents are living underneath the poverty line, possibly working multiple jobs. They just don't have time.
And they probably don't have money for high-dollar auction items either. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're talking about the demands on parents when it comes to school involvement for the rest of today's show, including this really big question of inequality. Let's start with Ellie Moxley, whose story inspired this whole discussion. Hi, Ellie.
Hi, Gina.
So what got you thinking about PTAs?
You know, in this case, it was actually a tip from a parent in the Shawnee Mission School District. She reached out to me on Twitter, asked if she could send me an email, if we could find a time to chat. And she just let me know that one of the things that she was hearing about in some of the parent groups that she's a part of, and there's a lot in Johnson County, it's a place where people really care about education and their kids' schools, was this idea that there were kind of have and have nots in the PTA land, and that, you know, the district wasn't doing a lot to kind of make sure that PTA money wasn't creating disparities between schools. So I started with that tip, and I dived into a whole world of PTA fundraising, and just to see kind of what I could find out. And as much time as I spent on it this semester, I still only feel like I probably scratched the surface.
Well, what kind of things happen through PTAs? For those of us who have not ventured into this world before, what is it? What goes on?
So let's start with the kind of typical things that PTAs pay for. I think the biggest things that I heard from the PTAs were, you know, we pay for teacher grants. The kind of we all hear about every year when kids go back to school in August, that teachers end up spending a lot of money on their classrooms, especially elementary school teachers. So one thing that a lot of PTAs try to do is set aside a little bit of money for those teachers so that they can kind of, you know, equip their classroom for the next group of kids coming in. And just to give you a sense of kind of where disparities come in, you know, in some schools, they're really proud of the fact that they're able to give teachers maybe $75, each classroom teacher $75. Other schools are able to give each classroom teacher $350. And this is in Shawnee Mission. So, you know, we start with that. Another thing that PTAs do is they'll pay for field trip fees so that it's not a question if the school is going on a field trip that a parent wouldn't be able to pay. Some PTAs do this on a kind of a scholarship basis. They have the principal just come to them and say, hey, we've got, you know, five or six kids or maybe more that, you know, their parents can't afford this one. Can you pull into your PTA field trip fund and fund that for us? Other schools just, you know, other PTAs are able to fundraise enough that they can, you know, kind of take that question out entirely by just paying for all the field trips that students take that year.
What else do PTAs do besides raise money?
You know, they do events that kind of foster community in the school. I think one of the things that every school talks about is a carnival or a fun fair. And what I think is really interesting is the role that this plays. In some schools, it's purely just a fun event for parents and students to come to the school and, you know, play carnival games and eat cotton candy and get hyped up on sugary cola. And in other schools, the carnival is the fundraiser. It is the way that that PTA pays for all of the activities that they're going to do that year.
What does that difference get at? I mean,
sure. So in terms of kind of the way that PTAs raise money, we don't know a lot about PTAs that don't bring in a lot of money because the IRS doesn't require nonprofits that bring in less than $50,000 a year to file a lot of details. They file their taxes on a postcard. That's all they have to do. They basically have to sign off on a statement that says, we brought in less than $50,000 last year. So, of course, that's a huge range. You could bring in $500. You could bring in $5,000. You could bring in $49,999, and you would be in that same pot. We can find out a little bit more when we look at these PTAs that are bringing in more than that. And, you know, we can see what sorts of things that they're paying for because we actually can take a look at their tax records. And you find out that it goes from funding teacher grants and field trips and, you know, putting on fun activities, Red Ribbon Week, Reading Week, those kinds of activities at the school, to actually paying for staff positions to benefit the kids. And those can be really supplemental programs, such as maybe a language immersion experience, like paying for a teacher to come in and get kids versed in a foreign language. Or it could be paying for extra aids, such as, you know, reading and math aids, just, you know, more adults to work with children to make sure that they're gaining those critical skills at a young age. Or it, one of the things that came up at a lot of schools was social workers and guidance counselors. They feel that Shawnee Mission is maybe trailing some of their peer school districts in Johnson County, such as Blue Valley and Olathe, in providing those in every building every day. And they want more of that for their kids.
And so it's interesting, though, because the schools where you would think maybe a social worker would be in the highest demand might also be schools where a social worker would be really out of reach for a PTA to fund.
Sure. And in those cases, what you're really talking about is there's basically three groups of schools. There's Title I schools. Those are schools that get federal dollars because they serve a large percentage of low-income children. And that money helps the district pay for things like extra aides and social workers. In that case, that's seen as kind of helping level the playing field. We recognize that low-income kids sometimes need that extra help to kind of keep pace with their more affluent peers. So that money comes from the federal government. Then there's the most, on the other side of the spectrum, there's more affluent schools. These are schools where there might be a lot of capacity to do this kind of PTA fundraising, where parents are saying, our kids have social emotional needs too. We really want to fund these positions. We want to make sure that, you know, everything our kids need, that it's paid for. And if the district won't pay for it, we see it as a basic need and we're going to pay for it ourselves. One of the things my reporting didn't really get into were these kind of schools that are in the middle, schools that, you know, they're maybe making more than $5,000 with a school carnival, but they don't make the kind of money that you need to pay for some of these extra positions. And they really, you know, these are probably more middle income or, you know, upper, lower, middle, you know, kind of class families that, you know, and they don't have the resources to necessarily provide them, but they aren't at their kids' schools either because of Title I dollars.
So, you know, as the educational landscape kind of evolves in Kansas City, a refrain I hear a lot is, well, hey, if you want the public school in your neighborhood to be stronger, send your kids there and get involved. Do you hear that too?
I do. And I think that's really true. I think that we know just in general that more involved parents mean better schools. This is something you hear all the time in schools that maybe are lower performing, that don't score as well on state tests. You know, if you go talk to those teachers and you go talk to those principals, you hear that, you know, one of the things we really wish is that we could get more parent engagement, but, you know, it's always the same 10 parents who show up to everything and we don't reach out, you know, we don't get a chance to see the rest of that parent population. And that's for a lot of reasons. I mean,
people can read things into that that might not be totally fair to the parent.
Right. And I think one of the ideas that has come up in my reporting is the idea of time affluence. The idea that, you know, if you're working, even if you are, you know, because in a lot of families now, even in families that are super involved in the PTA, both parents work. But there's a big difference between having like a 9-to-5 office job with a little bit of flexibility built into your schedule where, you know, if you need to cut out a couple hours early to go do something at your kid's school, you can do it, versus parents who are still doing shift work that are, you know, maybe working multiple jobs that are, you know, just doing everything they can to survive and get by. And they struggle to maybe they don't have the money to give and they definitely don't have the time to give.
Yeah, I mean, you have more authority over how you spend your time, depending on kind of where you rank at your workplace, too.
Absolutely. You know, people that have a little bit of seniority, that, you know, that they have the luxury of taking a position where they do have that kind of flexibility of a work-life balance. And that's a position of privilege. And that's kind of like what lets them get involved, which isn't to say that there aren't super engaged, involved parents that, you know, might be living below the poverty line. It's just harder. It's just harder.
Let's talk about how schools came to rely so much on parents in the first place and whether that's really a new thing. Our next guest is a professor. She teaches philosophy of education at Loyola University in Chicago. Amy Shuffleton, good morning.
Good morning.
In a paper you wrote on this, you explore parent involvement as typically mother's involvement. So you see it as gendered.
Absolutely. It's raced and classed in some of the ways that your reporter just mentioned, that there are that parents who have resources are better able to get involved than parents who don't. But it's also true that disproportionately it's women who are doing this. It's mothers.
So your main thesis, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, is that education reform movements right now often do center around parent involvement, but they ignore that what they're asking usually moms to do is not just work, but gendered work, political work, unpaid work. At the same time, is they're being asked to do more of it.
Yeah, exactly. I think if you look, if you take a historical perspective, right, parents have always been involved in their local schools. One of the interesting things about the United States as compared to other industrialized nations, you know, Germany, France, England, is that our school system, ever since its beginning, has always been very much based on local control. So that means that parents have had, because parents are local citizens, right, have had more opportunities to decide what's going on in the school, to resist school initiatives that they didn't like, to control things like curricula and hiring of teachers and so forth. In the 1960s, that shifted a bit because the federal government got more involved with Johnson's ESEA, which is what Title I is Title I of, the Elementary School and Education Act, which provided more federal funding for schools, which took some of the decision-making also out of local schools' hands and out of parents' hands. At about the same time in 1968, there was a report by James Coleman, a sociologist, which said actually that really what made the most difference to kids' education was the family and was the social capital, he called it, that they got through their parents being involved in the school. So you have this, since the 1960s, this interesting tension where, like, on the one hand, parents are less involved politically in their schools in the sense that they have less decision-making power over what happens in the schools, but they're also increasingly believed to be more responsible for whether the schools are successful or not. At the same time, like, as education budgets are being squeezed, mothers have been a source of cheap, unpaid labor. Because, parents are willing to do what it takes to give their kids a good education, especially historically moms, because it's been seen as their responsibility.
Do you have kids?
I do. I have two kids who are 14 and 11.
How has this changed in the time that you've been in the education world as a parent?
I think what's changing is that there's been more awareness of how this leads to inequality. That when my youngest daughter started kindergarten, so that was back in 2008, I guess, or 9, that it was just everybody was gung-ho about get involved and save your kid's school by sending your kid there and raising money for it. And then I think we started noticing that, reporters like you started picking up that, wait a minute, maybe this wasn't really so good for everybody. And so now there's been more of a critical, maybe this is not the best way to save our schools.
As just someone who's like on the ground experiencing this as a parent, but also on the side looking into it as a researcher, is there something that on the ground experience shows you about this whole dynamic that you wouldn't necessarily have data on? Or you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember when my first daughter started kindergarten, right? It was when I was just starting work as a professor, so I was trying to get tenure. I was putting in really long hours. I was commuting, in fact. Like, I worked 100 miles away from home. I had an infant, right? I had no time to put into school stuff. But I would try, like, once a year to go in and help with, like, the Scholastic Book Fair or to bake something for a bake sale or something, you know, and it nearly killed me, but I did it. And I was just astounded by the mothers who were putting in hours and hours and hours. And I realized that my daughter got to go to this great public school that had drama and had music and had after-school programs because of the work that they were putting in. And it seemed, really unfair to me in a couple of dimensions. For one, that there was this school that my daughter was getting all this benefits out of, even though I wasn't really putting nearly as much in as these moms who had given up their careers in a lot of cases to stay home with their kids. And they were putting in tons of time. So that wasn't fair that I was depending on them. It also wasn't fair that, like, this is an upper middle class neighborhood school, and they had the time, and that there were schools in other neighborhoods that didn't have that at all.
Did it also feel unfair to you that it was mostly women doing paid labor?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I could see directly, because these women were upper middle class professional women who had had, you know, they'd been working as social workers, lawyers, journalists, union organizers, things like that. And they'd left work because it was just too hard to do that job and have any time to spend with your kids. And they weren't earning enough money to make it worth it. I mean, you know, they're still.
And the school seemed to need them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they had a sense that if they didn't do it, nobody else was going to do it.
It is interesting to me that your point on some level is also that it's no longer for, like, what you would call extras that PTAs exist, or for support, or for parents to be functioning within the school walls as parents, that they are really on some level functioning as, like, crucial staff.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's worth us all asking ourselves as voters, as taxpayers, why it is that we accept that for kids to have things like foreign language instruction, social workers, guidance counselors, classroom reading libraries, that we have to depend on moms basically to do this. Why shouldn't somebody else be taking responsibility for this?
Ellie Moxley, tell me how this plays out just as far as what you've witnessed here in Kansas City in your reporting.
You know, I think I've seen the same thing that you know, and I want to say every PTA parent I talked to, which, again, most of them were women. I did talk to one PTA dad in all of this, and they all spend so many more hours than I think anyone realizes doing this work. It's largely thankless. They are constantly at the schools. They're constantly doing the work. And usually the other parents, maybe the less involved parents, have an opinion about how they're doing it. And, you know, so I think that's one of the things that I definitely heard.
I guess I would guess that administrators and teachers also have opinions about how they're doing their work.
I'm sure they do. I didn't really get into that. I get the sense that in a lot of these PTA in these schools where the PTA is funding actual positions at the school, there is a pretty close working relationship between teachers and principals. I heard from a lot of the different schools that do that, that fund positions with PTA money, that, you know, they send out surveys. They try to get the opinions of, you know, the school staff as well as the other parents before they make decisions, so that they kind of have some, you know, they have something that kind of is backing these decisions up. And, you know, the other thing is, too, I think that these moms, especially at the wealthier schools in Shawnee Mission, they're well aware that there are equity issues in this. They are, you know, they want to do everything they can to make sure that they get their kid the education that they think they deserve. But, you know, at the same time, they're not at all ignorant of the fact that there are other schools in Shawnee Mission that have to get by with a lot less.
And does that feel like a call to action, or just something that they feel powerless to address because of the way the system is?
I mean, I think part of it is when they have gone, for example, there was a big push that was really PTA led last spring to, you know, go to school board meetings and ask for, you know, more of the social emotional support. The district's position is, I mean, they want it too. They recognize that it's needed. But at the same time, you know, they say, we're coming off of a lot of lean years in Kansas where school funding at the state level hasn't been maybe where it is. When you do have a district that is as socioeconomically diverse as Shawnee Mission, you know, you don't necessarily have the tax base that some of the really wealthy districts do. So it is a challenge.
Call 816-235-2888 with your stories and observations. We'll get right to them after this break. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about the role of parent groups like PTA organizations in supporting schools. The ability of parents to give time and money varies from one community to another, and that can result in some pretty stark differences in educational resources. But why are schools so reliant on parents in the first place, and how do those expectations affect your life? Call 816-235-2888 with your story. My guests so far have been KCUR's Ellie Moxley and Lori Loyola University's Amy Shuffleton. Amy's with us from Chicago. Hi again, Amy.
Hi there.
And welcome back, Ellie.
Thanks.
So we are going to get to our calls. We've got a couple more guests to bring in, but I want to hear from Natika in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Natika.
Hi there.
What do you have to share?
I've just been listening to the conversations, and I guess it's a different experience based on what school district that your children belong to. I have five children. They've all been at separate schools, and the involvement is quite different among each school. So it's just interesting to just kind of contrast the pros and cons of being in a larger school and a smaller school, a public school, a private school, and even in a smaller community. Right now, my children are in a Kansas City, Missouri charter school, which has over 600 students. But 3 years ago, they were in a small private school in a city that had about 50,000 to 60,000 people. So that was a huge difference in my experience.
How did that difference show up in parent involvement specifically?
Well, in the smaller school in a smaller town, the parent involvement was significantly higher. So here in a larger school with more parents or more students, the percentages are smaller as far as parent involvement. And I think maybe some of that is because in a smaller school, they may be more dependent on the parent involvement in a PTO to fund positions or to raise money to help out with the school's budget, as opposed to a larger public school that can receive funding from other areas. So right now our PTO is quite small.
How does that affect you as a parent and your kids in terms of the education they're getting?
Well, I guess I don't see a difference in involvement. It's I kind of base the involvement upon what the environment of the school is. So if I'm welcome to be involved, then I will find a way to be involved. And then I will work with the school to see what the best way for me to serve the school. So whether it's fundraising or volunteering or giving up my time, talent, or treasure, just trying to figure out how I can be involved as a parent. But I think that mostly depends on the school environment. So I've been a part of schools.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think that this would be a good time to bring in Michael Dayton. He joins us from Kansas City, Missouri. He's responsible for reaching out to parents at KIPP KC. That's a charter school at 18th and Vine, and it's part of a national network of college track schools in what they call underserved communities. Hi, Michael.
Good morning.
So she was just talking about the importance of feeling welcomed to be involved as a parent. Can you talk about that?
It's just critical, and it's all based on the administration. It's them welcoming the parents, giving them an avenue to do things from coming and reading to the class, walking your child to breakfast, maybe sitting down and having breakfast with them, to participation in fundraising, culture events. We are strategically located on 18th and Vine, and we are multicultural. And having parents that are willing to give of their time and talents really goes a long way.
So, you know, you are kind of getting at that the PTA is not the only way for parents to be involved, at least not at your school.
Gina, that's a very good point. You know, don't get me wrong. As you guys stated earlier, parent involvement is critical to our child's development and education. When they see someone supporting, it doesn't have to be necessarily father, mother, it can be grandparent, aunt, uncle, or just a champion in the community looking over their shoulder and saying, hey, this is important, pay attention. We find that the kids do better. But again, with parent involvement, from serving on a PTO board or just coming in, having a book fair or sitting for an hour in a class, that means the world to us.
So how do you make sure that there are opportunities for parents, regardless of, you know, for parents, grandparents, caregivers of any kind, regardless of their outside obligations, their financial constraints, you know, this whole range of different life situations that people are bringing to the table?
It's all a function of programming. We were fortunate last year. We participated in a grant through School Smart KC, and they did a fellowship where they encouraged schools. There was about 11 schools, and we outlined a program of what was most important to us. How do we get in the parents involved? So, for example, we developed a tutoring program for our first graders because some of our first graders were behind in reading. So what we did is we engaged the parents, had them come in. We taught them what was important, how to educate your child, just how to ask questions. You know, you and I both know, it goes a long way by just asking somebody, hey, how was your day? What did you learn? Just something that simple. So we just outlined programs. We continuously look for ways to get involved.
You know, if you were to imagine a perfect world, what would parental involvement look like and what would it not look like? Like, where might be the lines between what the school is doing, what education professionals are doing, and what parents are doing? Mm-hmm.
Gina, the point you bring up to me is critical. Is education for our children are three-legged stool. You have the parents, you have the teacher, and you have the student. It would be nice if we can divide. We understand that parents have to work. They have to earn a living for their children. But if they can spend a moment a week saying, hey, let me get in touch with teachers, let me check on their grades, let me check on their social behavior to make sure that they are making progress and don't get behind, that to us is worth its weight in gold.
I want to talk now to June in Platte City. June is a PTA dad. Hi, June.
Hey.
What do you want to share?
Well, I mean, it's Jim, but I'm involved in PTA. There's not many dads, it's mainly moms. In fact, today I'm doing Santa store activities. But one thing I've noticed is dads tend to be more involved, like as coaches and den leaders and Awana leaders. Like last night, my son had wrestling practice. There were six dads on the mat with him, and we're a rural school. There's probably 700 kids in our school. So the involvement on the parent side's pretty significant, I would think, given our numbers. But dads tend to do stuff outside of PTA, but also for the kids program.
So do you think that there might be, though, a difference in like a pressure on you to put in time regardless of how much of it you have, for example, in the same way that I think a lot of moms are expressing that they feel?
Well, I think I'm required to do it. I mean, I've got three kids involved, and I'm married with my wife. But I see this part of being a dad because I don't think you can raise your kids if the dad is absent. And when I mean to say absent, that includes being involved in school. Because if I'm up at the school, then apparently it's got to be important for them to be at school and pay attention.
Well, Jim, thank you for calling.
Mm-hmm.
I want to turn to a guest in studio who has not been introduced yet. Megan Peters has two kids in a Shawnee Mission school, one that maybe doesn't fit some of the stereotypes of Shawnee Mission schools. Thanks for being here, Megan.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about your kids' school and what inspired you to get involved in the PTA.
Sure. So my kids go to a Title I school in Shawnee Mission. My daughter actually graduated from sixth grade last year, so she's in middle school now, but she was there from kindergarten through sixth grade, and I have a second grader there now, Rose Hill Elementary School. And, you know, our PTA is just full of people that are working so hard for our kids, but it's not as robust as in some of the other schools. It's not considered a status symbol to be on the PTA. We are constantly looking for more people to be involved, trying to recruit people to be on the board. That's not something that people are clamoring to do, which I think is a little bit different from experiences that I've heard from other parents in other schools in our district.
You know, I'm curious about the overall picture of parental involvement in the school's ecosystem.
Sure. So, you know, parents at a Title I school, again, it's just a little bit different. You have parents that are working multiple jobs. You have parents that are working hourly jobs. You have parents that maybe don't have paid leave, that cannot come into the school in the middle of the week and lead book club at 11 a.m.
But then you have some parents that can. And so what ends up happening is you have this, you know, core group of parents that are kind of doing everything. And that can easily lead to burnout, where these, especially moms, like you've talked about, feel this pressure. And I know I certainly do as a mother, to do everything I can to be in the school. And eventually it's just too much for some parents and they have to take a step back. And then again, we're looking, we're trying to recruit, we're trying to find new people. And that can be challenging.
On the other side is, do you think that there's ever some resentment too, that, you know, there's this, what can maybe feel like lead parents in the school community?
Sure, absolutely. And I've honestly been on both sides of that. My kids are 4.5 years apart. So when my daughter started kindergarten, my son was an infant. I was working full time out of the home, you know, 50, 60 hour weeks. I didn't have the time to go in and volunteer during the day. And there were times where I really felt like I wasn't as involved in the decision making that was happening in the schools. And I couldn't contribute in that same way. Or maybe I was seen as, you know, lesser because I wasn't there and I wasn't giving that amount of time. And now I'm kind of on the other side of that. I am on the PTA board and I am at a lot of the events. And so I think that there are definitely two sides to that. We also have a school community where many of the kids and many of the parents are non-English speaking. So there's a barrier there as well, where we need to make a great effort to make sure that they're all included, that all our communications go out in English and Spanish so that everybody feels like they can be involved.
Amy Shuffleton of Loyola University, chime in here.
Sure. I mean, it sounds like Megan's addressing a lot of the stuff that I talked about earlier. I mean, the pressure that moms feel. You know, one thing I realized I should have said, this is responding to Jim's comment, really, that another thing that I think has changed in the last 10 years is that there is more pressure on dads to get involved. But again, I don't necessarily think that's a good thing, that because it just means that dads are feeling the same pressure that moms are feeling, that really we ought to be providing these resources for kids anyway.
You know, I mean, it's one of the things people say about the home work juggling act that parents do in 2018 is that, you know, you're supposed to parent like you don't work and work like you don't parent. But it also sounds like you're supposed to be present at the school like you don't do either of those things.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And we, you know, if you listen to the discourse about it and a lot of the, to what people say about it in newspapers and magazines, you know, it gets talked up as if, you know, if you love your kids, you'll do this. And I think people feel really guilty if they can't, or if they, you know, I mean, honestly, if they don't want to, like sitting and reading to a bunch of first graders is not everybody's cup of tea. And I don't think it needs to be.
Megan, give us the parents' perspective here, because on the one hand, you do have these outside expectations, but part of what we're talking about is an internal pressure and a desire that people feel, whether they have a life that allows them to act on that necessarily or not.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know what the answer to that is. I think, you know, being especially a woman and a mother, that's really all I can speak to because that's my only experience. But there is this expectation that you're supposed to be all things to everyone. And we just don't have that much gas in the tank. We cannot fill up everyone's cup. And so you have to create boundaries and give when you can. So like when my children were, I was in the position where I couldn't be in the school, I did try to do my best to donate money or share things online if we were doing events, if I was capable of doing that. And just trying not to make myself feel worse about not being there. I mean, sometimes it's just inevitable. I think that's unfortunately just kind of part of being a mother. You just always feel like you're never going to give 100% everywhere. But you just have to do the best you can and set boundaries that are healthy for you and your family, because you also can't be a great mother if you're constantly stretched so thin that then you can't be there for your kids when they maybe need you at home or something like that.
Ellie Moxley, you know, you have done tons of reporting on this. You've talked to lots of parents in lots of different schools. And I'm curious what questions you still have after, because you've said you feel like you've just scratched the surface of this really what turns out to be a vast topic.
Yeah, one of the things that I didn't get into in this reporting is that on top of PTA money, a lot of schools, more affluent schools, have education foundations that just benefit that individual school building. And there's a lot of money available there. And that's one avenue that I didn't even get a chance to look at.
So I'm guessing you probably will.
Probably.
Our time is up, but keep talking about the pressures on parents to be involved and the benefits of being involved on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Megan Peters, parent and PTA member at a Title I school in the Shawnee Mission District, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Michael Dayton with us from KIPP-KC, thank you.
Thank you.
Amy Shuffleton, it's been great having you in from Loyola in Chicago.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And Ellie Moxley, thank you for inspiring this conversation with your reporting.
Thanks for having me on.
Ellie is KCUR's education reporter, and that's a wrap for today's show. Both of the conversations we had today will be online at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow is a food show. We'll talk about food styling for the Fab Five, a winter cocktail recipe, and a search for the best Indian food in town. Join us for that tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, Chris Young, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.